I'm only 1 second off.
Log Talk Radio.
Here we go.
This is All About Wine, a talk show dedicated to the wine industry since 2009. Featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast and around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Ron.
All right. The bus people seem to be quite happy tonight. I guess the big news is, before we get to our guest who is in the green room right now, the big news is the hurricane that just passed by us here.
Yeah.
I'm just north of Tampa, and Mike is over just south of Orlando, and we dodged the major part of the storm. We were on the right-hand side of the spins. We did get our water and wind and rain, but we didn't get storm surge. Up and down the coast, they had water on the streets of all the coastal communities. But we survived quite well. We didn't get it too bad. And so it wasn't, stuff in the yard and branches and stuff. But places like Crystal River, which pretty much flattened it, and there's other areas up there where it went in, were devastated. So if you are so inclined to donate to things for recovery efforts and stuff, American Red Cross, and ask them to put it toward the hurricane recovery. That's really the best thing to do. They do a good job, and there's people that don't have homes, and there's some places that were being flooded, and they caught on fire, and I mean businesses and stuff. It was horrible, horrible up there. So, like I say, if you are so inclined, want to donate anything, American Red Cross, for the flood victims. And they will get distributed and help people and all that. So, had to talk about that since we were right at the edge of it. Yeah. Part of it there. So,
all right.
Well, we have ourselves a guest tonight, Terry Shumrick. I hope I pronounced that right. I should have asked him how he pronounced his name before anything. Terry Shumrick. He is an actor and a winemaker, and he has a winery and all sorts of stuff. We talked to him for a few minutes before the show, and we're going to bring him on. We're going to talk about the same stuff again because he was telling us all sorts of interesting things that you all might want to listen to it too. So, Terry, welcome to All About Wine.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. My whole life is all about wine, but wait a minute, not really, because I'm also a master distiller. I make bourbon every day. Yeah, I make bourbon and rums and agaves along with my winemaking. Yeah, so I do a lot of different things. I've got a really interesting life, I'll tell you that much. Very, very exciting every single day.
And an actor on top of all that too. Wow.
The acting came about because I did a little pilot program where I wanted to go into different wineries around the country and go in and do a half an hour deal about the wineries and what they're doing and how they're doing it and that kind of a thing. And that's where my acting career started. So, that didn't quite work out the way I wanted it to. But one day I'm in my distillery and a guy comes in, he's a writer, and you got to remember, we're here in Cincinnati, so we're as far away from, you know, everything in the whole country.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we're as far away from Hollywood as you can get. And he said, I know a producer, or actually a director, and brought the director in. We started talking about, I want to do a series. And she talked me into doing a full-length movie, which is 102 minutes. It's called Wine Thief. And that's how the acting side of my life got going, actually.
Oh,
so
okay.
It was, you know, filming a movie in Paso Robles. I might add this. My brother is Tobin James. He's got a winery out in Paso Robles, really, really famous winery. He's a famous guy. They make great wines. They have the largest wine club. This is, okay, this is what they're saying, in the world with, over 25,000, people that get a shipment twice a year. And it's a big deal. Tobin James Winery in Paso Robles. If anybody's thinking about going to Paso Robles, go to Tobin James. Tell them that you know Terry, and go up to the bar and tell everybody at the bar that you know me, and I guarantee you, there'll be free wine flowing your way.
Well,
yeah, they hate me when I do this kind of stuff.
Before you get yourself painted into a corner here, Toby's going to be on the show in 3 or 4 weeks here. So I'll let him know that you are offering free wine just by mentioning your name, and we'll see how he responds to that.
I love it. I love it. You know, he's my younger brother, so I get to trump him every time. So no matter what happens, I get to rule. So, yeah, it's a great thing. Tobin James, the winery is if you look it up, it's a classic, I want to say a Western theme. And it's the coolest winery in Paso Robles. They're all about, you know, making sure you understand what the wines are all about that they're producing. They want you to have a good time when you walk in the door. It's really, really a great place to stop when you're in Paso Robles.
We'll pass it on to Toby when he comes on. And when you're in Cincinnati, you also have your winery. So where is that located? What's the name of that?
Well, I sold my winery and distillery to an outfit called 50 West that I still work for. So I bounce back and forth between wine and bourbon, rye, vodkas, agaves, dark rums. You know, I kind of go back and forth. Oh yeah. We do a lot. But my primary focus on the wine side, if y'all can believe this, is blackberry, blueberry, raspberry, and strawberry. Now, you know, most people are saying, oh, I don't know about, you know, if I like those or not. But let me tell you, we sell tremendous volume of all four of those wines. And because people talk dry, and then when you give them something sweet, they buy sweet. I mean, I see it. I see it everywhere. I don't even drink my own wines. I don't drink them. I mean, you know, I'd rather have a nice Zin or a Cab or Pinot or whatever. And but there are so many people that love blackberry wine. It's incredible, especially on east of the Mississippi.
There was a guy. Yeah. I had a winery down here in Florida, and I closed it down. But a few years ago, maybe 8-9 years ago now, a guy came in. He was sipping my wine. He says, I open up a wine. He says, I make all my wine even drier than yours. My wine would be so dry. And I'd say, and then people would come in and taste it and start walking out the door because it's not sweet enough. And you'd be chasing after them saying, I'll add sugar, you know, because people do like the sweeter wines. You know, it's just overall, I mean, the majority of people would prefer some sweetness to their wines as opposed to the dries. I mean, it's just
absolutely
been
you come to Cincy, and I'm not talking Cincinnati, but I'm talking Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, West Virginia. And, you know, the very first wineries were right here in Cincinnati, and some people will say over in Kentucky. But, you know, everybody grew Concord. And
yeah.
that's
oh, yeah.
where all the sweet wines got going. And,
yeah.
You know, right here where I'm sitting used to be a vineyard at my house. And I live in Hyde Park in Cincinnati.
Oh,
and
okay.
it was a Concord. Yeah. It was Concord, Catawba, and Niagara. And that's
mm-hmm.
what people started in America. And the good thing is in upper New York and out in California and a lot of other places in the country, you know, really good dry wines started to really crop up in the early 70s. And then they started blossoming in the 80s and 90s. And people really refined their acts in, you know, in 2000 and moving forward. So there's everything for everybody. I just have to be on the sweet side.
I have, well, a couple of weeks ago, was it Mike? I'm getting confused on the dates. I had a gentleman on who is an advocate for American wines and not American grapes and American wines. And he said they're all not sweet. He said, you know, we tend to label American grapes as sweet, but they're not. He said there's a lot of drier styles out there that people just don't give it a chance. It goes back to
Riesling. Back when I was growing up, and probably you guys too, you know, Riesling was a sweet wine. And
yeah,
that's what it was. Now you can get dry Rieslings that are really, really good, and you would never believe that they're a Riesling because they're dry.
Right, yeah.
So,
no,
yeah,
that's true.
There's a lot of, yeah.
A lot of people think that, you know, when they say Riesling, well, I love a good Riesling. I said, sweet or dry? Well, they're sweet. No. And Germany makes the sweet Riesling, so people are tend to, you know, think sweet that way, and they don't equate it to the fact that they can be dry. So, yeah. Your movie, you're an actor. You went to California. They said, here, let's go do a movie.
Yeah.
Without, you know, give us a teaser. I don't want to, about the movie, but I want the people out there to know enough about it to want to go see it, but don't tell them what it is. So then that way they don't say, oh, I don't need to see it. I already know. What's the movie about?
Well, I mean, first of all, you can go on YouTube and go just type in Wine Thief trailer. And that will give you our trailer as to, you know, the actors that are in it and a little bit about the movie. But the movie is about two competing wineries that are trying to win the Golden Globe Wine Awards. And the one that wins it gets to do the series that I was talking about earlier. You know, that they get this series on television. So, you know, to talk about wine and stuff. And it's a comedy. And
wow.
It's all about wines. And this is not a documentary. This is a funny show. There's a lot of funny stuff that happens in the show. Because when we were doing it, and I helped the guy that wrote the movie, Brian Dobkins, you know, I helped him. I said, look, it's got to be funny. And we changed a whole lot of things in the movie to make it more fun, happy. It's not quite a Hallmark film, but it's a feel-good film. So much scenery in Paso Robles that it's incredible.
Beautiful area.
Yeah, and we shot it at Toby's Winery.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, there was three wineries, actually, Crowed and Calcareous and Toby's. And then we filmed it at his house, which is, you know, ask him about his house when he comes on because
okay. –
He may not want to talk about it, but it's incredible. And when you see some of the trailer, it's the whole movie was fun for about the first 3 days. And then it got to, then it was hard because you had to be on set. You had to know your lines. you had to be an actor, and when you kind of have to like lose touch with reality and become the person that you're playing. Now, mm-hmm. fortunate for me, I was playing me. And Toby was played by a different actor, but you know, so I got to be me, but I had to, you know, kind of lose touch with the reality to get into these scenes and try to portray, you know, what we were doing to, you know, to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you see a good actor on television, you know what, praise them, because it is hard when, you know, I mean, when you have to know lines and when to give them, and especially a long, you know, a long drawn out line that you've got, it's intense, because we don't live our lives like you see me on film. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, you watch a lawyer film, these guys are talking lawyer stuff. I couldn't do that. You have to be way smarter than me as an actor to do that type of acting. So,
or even doctor stuff,
you know, yeah. I mean, so people who want to be actors and they think they can do it, you know, it's a little bit harder than you think. You know, being on the radio is harder than people think. I mean, I've been on the radio for 25 years doing sports, and, you know, we all know that there are times that crop up where things get quiet and you've got to jump in, and it's the same with acting. You have to be right on all the time. Now, that being said, it was fun. I mean, don't get me wrong. We had our share of wines and probably went to the set the next day a little more hungover than we should have been. But maybe you'll see that in the film. You know? Yeah.
But the movie is not technical then. It's not talking about things about wine. I mean, the name of the movie, Wine Thief, you know, I don't know if people are familiar, but that's the little thing you stick into a barrel of wine and you it brings out wine so you can put it in the glass and you can test and taste the wine that's in the barrels and stuff like that. That's a wine thief, and that's the name of it. I mean, it's not like people stealing wine.
Right.
The movie itself is not full of the technical terms about wine, and it's not going on with different things like that. Then it's just
it's you know, we do use the wine thief in the movie, but you see a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of wine drinking going on, but there is no technical aspect of the movie at all. It's all about, it's a comedy. We're drinking wine and we're, you know, trying to beat the other winery at their own game. And so it's a comedy. I mean, I could tell you, but like you said, I don't want you to know the ending.
No, we don't want to know.
Of course,
that.
You probably know the ending, but,
but
yeah, so it's
no,
not a documentary at all.
Okay, good.
Yeah, it's a comedy. I mean, it's something that when it comes out, it's probably going to come out in January. You know, it's snowing out or down in Florida, it's beautiful and you're playing golf. But, I mean, it's something you can sit down, and if you watch the trailer, it's exciting. I mean, you get this, oh, yeah, I would watch this. So it's a good wine movie. There's a couple of them out that I'm sure a lot of people have seen. And, it's you know, this is a comedy. It's not like those shows, so.
Well, it should be fun. What the wineries that they're at? What side of not one? What 101? You know, what are they, east or west of?
All the wineries are in Paso Robles.
Yeah, but the main highway that runs down through Paso Robles. I can't think of the name of it.
Yeah,
it's
101.
101. Okay.
101. And 46 runs through.
Yeah, 46.
The winery. Yeah. It's on 46, but from, if you're coming into Paso Robles, it's on the east side of 101.
Okay.
On the east side of 1.
Yeah, okay.
So you're heading
well,
back towards Bakersfield on 46.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I'm familiar with the area, and I just wondered where it was, where the wine is located. The last time I was out there was, it had to be 12 years ago. I was last time I was out in Paso Robles. So no,
you need to go back because Toby he'll do you right. One thing about Toby, he treats everybody the same, and that's with grandeur. I mean, he's very, very, very accommodating. He's, when you're around him, you just get this, you know, the energy level is up five notches. He's very, very generous. You come to his house, and he doesn't care who you are. You're going to be treated just like everybody else that's ever been to his house, which is wonderful.
Oh, sounds like a great person. I'm looking forward to talking with him. Your movie, okay, it's not out yet. You in passing said you expect in January. What's your next step here? You know, we were talking about a little bit before the show,
right.
But what's your next step with the movie here? What's going to be
okay,
happening?
So we're going to go to the American film market, and the American film market, which, you know, until I didn't even know this, but the American film market is where all the independent filmmakers in the United States, and I'm generalizing that, come to this market to sell their films. These films are represented. I mean, there's people from, all over the world that come to this to buy films to, fill up their time slots in these different countries. I mean, I never knew all this. I mean, it's a lots and lots and lots of people from different countries. So what we're hoping to do is A, sell it here in the United States, and B, maybe sell it to, now I'm just talking here, Japan, right, and Australia and Norway, you know, where these people are looking for content. So
right.
It's you get a little booth and you sell your wares, as you might say.
Where is this located? So, where do they do this?
This is in Santa Monica.
Of Santa Monica,
so,
California. Okay.
Yeah, this will be on the 31st of October through like the 4th. So we'll be out there, me and Toby and the director. We'll all be there. You know, I've never been to anything like this. It's a really big deal. I mean, there's thousands and thousands of people that come. Yeah.
Wow.
It's good.
Never heard of that before. That sounds like a quite a time you're going to have there.
Oh, I promise you, I'm going to have quite the time. Because here's the greatest thing about going to California. I don't have to be an actor. I can be a character. And that's what I plan on doing.
Kind of in a character in California. California's
nobody
full of
characters. Knows, yeah. Well, nobody knows who I am, so I can be this character in California. And, I think it's just going to be fun. So that's where we're going next. And hopefully it leads to, like, we want to do a sequel. So, somebody buys it for enough, then we can do a sequel, and who knows where it's going to go from there.
Yeah, start coming up with a series of them. Well, it seems like the subject of trying to be the best in wine is sort of lends itself to not having a sequel. Once somebody wins, then you have a winner.
Yeah. I mean, I get what you're saying, but you have to remember, you know, anytime there's anything on any screen, it's basically fictional. And so the best thing about it is what we would do for the sequel is start filming as if we were doing half an hour shows.
Uh-huh.
And then the comedy that goes along with why these shows didn't work or why they did work or, you know, that kind of a thing. So comedy again. Yeah. So
just keep
it
on the same
genre
there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So it's fun.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds like a great way to do it. I want to talk a little bit more about your winery, your wines and stuff like that. We were just
okay.
We talked for just a minute, then we got sidetracked. Do you make the five wines, the five fruit wines, or have you turned it over to someone else?
No, actually, I do make them. So I'm right in there with the boots. Let me just back up a little bit. The Shumrick family here in Cincinnati started a winery back in 1986 in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
And we planted a big vineyard. And back in the day, the vinifera were, you know, just emerging. And we had Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Cabernet, Merlot, Sangiovese, along with, you know, the whole crop of American grapes, plus the French hybrids like Vidal, Saval, Deschenac, Foch.
You had all those?
We had all these. We had over 70 acres of grapes. All different types, because we had a big winery that had a reception area that could seat 250 people. We had a 170-seat restaurant. It was big time. And people would
Where
come
was
in
that located?
And it was located in a town called New Alsace, Indiana. From Cincinnati, it's about 40 minutes. So it's not very far away. Yeah, because, you know, Ohio butts right up to Indiana and Kentucky. So I can be in Kentucky in 10 minutes, in Indiana in 20 minutes. So we had a large winery out there producing all of our stuff right there. Everything was, you know, estate bottled right on the premise. And, you know, it was great. I mean, being a winemaker was wonderful back then, because got to remember, here – In Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, I mean, wines were, you know, these new wineries were popping up, and it was big back here. I mean, people were like, man, there's a winery. We can go to a winery on Saturday and taste wines and eat some food. So it was a big deal. And we were growing some really, really, really good grapes. We bought, you know, the Pinot Noir stock from upper New York, because it was acclimated to the weather up there. And, but the problem was the weather down here didn't cooperate all the time. I mean, we would get to, negative 20. I mean, you know, if you've lived in New York long enough, you've seen, you know, back in the day, it was really, really, really cold back here. And the viniferas do not do well. Yeah, they would. Nope. The trunks would split, and we would get every infection you could ever get into the vines, and we'd be cutting them down and bringing up the suckers and, you know, re-trellising them. So it was a labor of love. I mean, you know, you can only do it when you're young, because the one thing about growing grapes, the weather never cooperates when you're trying to work in the vineyard. Now,
never.
It's either cold or hot.
Yeah.
You get a
here in Florida,
days.
In the vineyard I had, it was either too wet or too dry, or, you know, bugs. I mean, you know, you're right. It's
I mean, it was just it would never cooperate. I mean, California and even up in New York and everything, the climates are less harsh, I should say.
Yeah,
but here
diverse.
In Ohio and Florida, it was tough. Yeah. So, but we did make some world-class Pinots. We had some really good Cabs. The one thing that we really did well was Chardonnay, because we could bring the Chardonnay grapes in. They didn't have to be at 21 Brix, you know, where everybody says it has to be. We could bring them in at 17 or 18 Brix, and the pH was right. And then what we would do is we would, you know, add sugar to take them up to maybe 22 or 23 Brix, and then put them in barrels. And then barrel fermented. And, this was the beginning of barrel fermentation. I mean, we're talking back in the, you know, in the 80s when even California was experimenting with it. And we do a malolactic fermentation in the barrel at fermentation, which was kind of unheard of, because most people did a malolactic after the fermentation was done.
After.
And I was like, no, we're going to do it all at once. Because it's always warm, and that malolactic does not like to, you know, do its thing when it's cool. So we did that, and, man, we made some really nice buttery Chardonnays from, you know, grapes out of Indiana that, you know, people came from all over the tri-state to taste them and buy them. I mean, we were always sold out of Chardonnay. But, so It's a really interesting market back here, as far as you know, people like local, but they really like local when it's really good. So,
when it's good,
yeah.
That's
what we did.
So that winery, how long did the family have it, and what happened to it, and do they still have it?
We sold it. It got to a point where it was big, and the family dynamics started playing into it. And I was out there every day. Yeah, I mean, you know, this is it's a tragedy, to be honest with you. And I'm one of nine kids.
Wow.
So you can only imagine. And a lot of the kids came out and worked out there and poured their heart and souls into it. And all of a sudden, when the money started rolling and it started getting bigger and we needed to expand and you need to put an extension over here and put new tanks in down there, new press, it got dicey. I don't even know how to put it. But, you know, if anybody who's owned a family business can understand this. And so one day we all decided, hey, look, we're just going to go ahead and sell this. And so we sold it.
Oh,
and that was the
was...
end of the, it was called Chateau Pommier. And
Pommier
it's spelled Pommiae, and that's my mother's maiden name. So it was House of Pommier. It was beautiful. You can go online and look it up. Just type in Chateau Pommier. It was sold, but the buildings, you know, they are still there. They're still operating it. It's a beautiful, beautiful tract of land out in the rolling hills of southern Indiana, all stone and wood, big fireplaces. It breaks my heart a little bit, you know.
Yeah, but I can imagine. It's still operating under the same name?
It is still operating under the same name. The new owners haven't pursued the passion that the Shumrick family had for it. And I think it's only open a few days a week. Because I also think that with the advent of all the breweries opening and distilleries opening, people's focus in America has shifted from the boutique wineries out in the country of, you know, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky to, hey, look, we can go to a local brewery. There's a couple local distilleries. You know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that's if you're not big right now in the Midwest, to open a winery is extremely difficult.
It's very hard to open one anyway because of all the rules and regulations. Every time I've talked to anyone that's just opened a winery, it's not like, okay, I think I'll open up a winery now, and by the end of the year, you're going to have it up and running. It takes 18 months to get the license and get everything approved, and it's ridiculous. The government fingers that they have in it and how long it takes to get everything approved along the line and all that. So, you know, I know it's, that's why,
you know, I broke all the rules. I broke all the rules. I made my first vintage in Indiana in a barn, in a cattle barn, because the winery hadn't been approved. So I moved the tanks up to the cattle barn, and there's literally a dirt floor, but we could move the press up there. I mean, that's where we did the first vintage, and we put it in stainless steel tanks. And finally, when we got our license, we moved it down and pumped it into the tanks down in the winery. So that's a true story. Yeah. Because you're right. I mean, we thought, we'd have a license in 6 months. That didn't work that way. And then I said, the grapes are coming. Yeah. We got to do something. And so we made it on the dirt floor. I wish I would have had a picture of what happened.
It takes forever to get the licensing and everything squared away. Yeah, it's absurd. And, you know, when somebody wants to open a wine, and that's, you know, not just federal, state, you got all the state hoops to jump through and then the federal hoops to jump through, and it's absurd. You know, I've had lots of people.
It takes time. I've gotten good at it because, you know, I've opened a winery there, opened a winery here in Cincinnati, and three distilleries. So, you know, so when it comes to the government stuff, I'm really pretty good at it, but it's only because I had to get good at it. If I didn't want to stay up all night trying to figure it out. So,
exactly.
Yeah, it's good.
That's just how it is, too. Is, you know, if you work at it and get good at it, you can usually just get it done right away. So the
right.
The distillery, you just mentioned that. Well, no, I'm not done with winery yet. Back up. So they sold that, and you all helped them, the new owners, get started and get going, I'm sure. And but then the winery that you have now, did you open that yourself, or the one with the fruit wine? Did you? Okay.
I did. I mean, it was an easy transition. So I'm out of Indiana, and I'm like, okay, what do I do? So I go to a winery in Kentucky that is very, very small. And I said, hey, what about if I make your wines for you and I make my wines for me? And, you know, we just kind of split it down the middle. I'll make, you know, I think they were growing Saval, they were growing Vidal, some Cab, and some Merlot. And I said, you know, I'll make your wines for you, but I want to make blackberry, blueberry, raspberry, and strawberry. And they're like, well, you're crazy, dude, but okay, we'll go with this. Yeah. They're like, we'll go with this. So, you know, I started making their wines, and then all of a sudden, you know, I produce my own stuff. And I said, you know, I'm going to go ahead and sell this. And so I start selling it. And now all of a sudden I'm working, you know, 12 hours a day on my stuff and 1 hour a day on their stuff. So we got together. Yeah, we got together. And I said, why don't we just put it under, you know, one umbrella, and I'll make everything. Here's my salary. And, you know, off to the races we go. Well, I mean, it became really, really obvious that when the semis are backing up and you're loading, you know, a half a semi full of pallets with blackberry wine on them, that, okay, the writing's on the wall. Yeah. I mean, we don't need to grow Cabernet or anything. You know, you can go out to, you know, a number of sources and buy the juice, bring it in, ferment it, put it in the bottles, and you got whatever you want, basically. But the blackberry, though, I mean, you know, I made so much money off of blackberry that it's ridiculous. And when I started making it back in the 80s, yeah, nobody was doing it yet, and I perfected it. I mean, I started using concentrates, which, you know, everybody was like, well, that's not being a purist and everything. And I said, well, check the Mercedes out. You want purist or you want a Mercedes? So this is how it is, you know. This is how we're going to roll with this conversation. And, you know, I did the same thing with the raspberry and the strawberry. And then I started doing cherry and pear and peach and all the other varieties. And it was easy, and the public liked those types of wines. And I was like, okay. So long story short, it was a family-owned business. And one day, you know, I see these kids growing up and getting older and older and older. And one day the owner of the winery comes up and says, well, you know, my son wants to start making wine. And I was like, you know, plan, you know, 67 needs to be implemented right now, because I could see the writing on the wall. I already lived through one. Now I'm living through another. And that's when I said, okay, I'm going to go do my own thing. And if I make it, I make it. If I don't, you know, I don't know what I'll do. But so it's a wild world in the wine world. And I really think you need a little bit of luck in the wine world to make your winery a success. It can't just be on, we're going to open it.
Oh, yeah. It's the old saying, too, you know how to make small fortune in the wine business, you start with a large fortune. And that's just, you know, everybody in the wine business knows that saying. I mean, it's something we all live with.
Toby, he started with a small fortune. When you have him on, his story about how he started, and I hope he mentions my name, because that was out there a lot. But he started a little tiny winery, and he lived above the winery. So he'd get up in the morning, stumble down the steps because Shumricks are drinkers, we'll admit it. And he stumbles down the steps, goes to work, and when he was done, he could stumble back up the steps. And then, as I always say in every business deal, this phrase comes out. And then one day. So, and yeah, that, every successful person has that saying in their repertoire. And then one day the state came in and said, on Highway 46, they said, we're going to put a turn lane into your street right here. And his winery's within 100 feet of the street. And that changed everything. So when you could get off the highway and, without getting run over and pull off and go to his place. And then one day it all changed. So, the small wineries, like I say, you need a little bit of luck to get big in the small winery business.
Yeah. Well, Paltaropos is so full of small wineries. I mean, it's amazing. You drive around the hills there and all that, and you go around a hill and you pull up this driveway, and here's a house with a garage with two barrels and a board, and that's their tasting room. And it's just phenomenal wines, but they make two wines, and that's it, a Cab and a Pinot Noir. But they're phenomenal. And then as you're going back down the hill, here's another one that has, instead of a garage, their shed. And two barrels and a board again. And I mean, it's all over Paltaropos like that. Unlike any other place I've ever been, Paltaropos is just full of those little small, people have, 5 acres or so.
Yeah. It's better than Napa, actually. I think Paltaropos is better than Napa because there's the tourism in Napa is so intense. You go to Paltaropos, it's a lot more laid back and everything's more spread out. You got to drive through those wonderful hills with the oaks, with the Spanish moss and, all the stuff. And you're right. It's magical when you go to Paltaropos.
And it's not costing you, $50 every time you want to do a tasting too. I mean, you go in, you have a couple of wines to taste, and they'll sit there and they'll talk with you about them and all that. And the person who made it is right there talking to you. You're not talking to a bunch of kids who are working the pouring or the tasting bar. And it's so much different in Paltaropos. I mean, as opposed to Napa or Sonoma.
Period. I mean, it's just a wonderful, wonderful place. And, for all the listeners out there, go to Paltaropos, and it's affordable. The hotels are affordable, the wines are affordable, easy to drive around, lots of entertainment at night. When you go down into Paltaropos versus going to Napa.
It's a real small town. Paltaropos is a little small town located right on 101, and if you want to, you're not too far from all sorts of other little small towns that have lots of stuff going on, but you can stay right there in Paltaropos. Last time I was out there, there's like 8 or 10 hotels right there in town, but it's a great place. I mean, it's a great little area and all that. And it's not Napa yet. It's still, within their own.
Well, and the other thing is the coast is 30 minutes away. You can go over to Morro Bay and you're right on the ocean and the best restaurants you've ever seen. And a lot of them are very inexpensive, so you can do the coast, one day and the wineries the next day. And, Monterey's not far away. San Luis Obispo isn't far away. So, I mean, there's a lot to do in that little tiny geographical area called Paltaropos.
It is, and it's easy to get to. I mean, it's very, very simple. If you fly into San Francisco, you can get yourself in a car, go down, and like Terry just said, Monterey, and you want to see a beautiful trip, go down Highway one long big spur and then cut across to Paso Robles. There you go. You've got your trip planned out for everybody out there now.
And then that's all you got to know right there. And you can go through the artichoke heart of the world, which
Castroville.
Right near Monterey. Crazy.
Yeah, Castroville, the artichoke capital of the world, Castroville, yeah. Well, I was stationed at Fort Ord back when it was a Fort Ord there.
I've been there.
Yeah, it's not Fort Ord anymore. I think I think it's a subdivision and whatever. I don't know. I haven't been there since they switched it over. But, yeah, I was stationed at Fort Ord, and so I had an opportunity to – 2 years I was there, so I had an opportunity to visit lots of areas around there and see lots of things. Fell in love with the area. It's just a beautiful area there. And so,
where that station was when we were out there in, I don't know, maybe it was, when were you out there? I mean, I was out there, I think it was still rolling in 1990, maybe.
Oh, it was before then. It's when I got back from Vietnam in 71. That's where I was for 71, 72. Then got married and lived there for another year. Went up to San Francisco, Concord, outside of San Francisco. Lived there for five more years. And so, you know, I was in that area. But it was, in the 70s, mid, late 70s.
It was fun. It was fun back then. It was really fun back then.
Different culture than it is now. I mean, it really is. Really. People don't understand how it's changed. But so you're making wine now. So how did you get into your whiskeys and your bourbons and your?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I was working. Okay, so when Chateau Pommier. When we decided to sell, I went to a winery in Kentucky called Stonebrook Winery. And while I was there, you know, I was making the wines, and I told you earlier about, you know, I was making theirs and I was making wine. But my brother Michael had a farm here in Milford, Ohio, which is probably only 20 minutes from my house. And I asked him if I could buy a still, put it on his farm, and start like practicing, you know, making some moonshine. And, you know, this is 13 years ago. So this is before, you know, all the hype came up. And so he said, sure. So I put I bought a still from down in Kentucky, just 100-gallon still. And, went out there and started perfecting my craft and soon learned that 100-gallon still is not a very big still. I mean, to get anything out of it, man, you were there all day long watching this stuff come out of this thing and going, okay, I'm really kind of bored with all this. But, you know, where's the end game? So I bought a 200-gallon still. Now, this one, you know, when we designed it, I said, look, you know, you have a big column that comes up and then like cranks over to the right. And what happens is every time these guys build these stills and these columns come up at 8 or 9 inches and they go across and then they condense them down to maybe a 3-inch, arm coming across into the condenser. And I'm like, okay, guys. No. You need to make what comes up 6-inch, come across 5-inch, go into the condenser at 4-inch because
this is going to be faster.
It's going to be a lot faster because it's already taken all the copper it can do. We've done everything magical we can do in the pot still, but now we don't want to be here for 12 hours. We only want to be here for 5 or 6 hours.
There you go.
Yeah, so little did I know, but 11 years ago, I started doing this, and all of a sudden, you know, everybody started doing it because I was preaching, you know, this is the way to do it. And so, I wish I could have patented it. But anyway, kind of a funny story when I'm out in Milford one day and I'm making some moonshine, and we're not really selling it yet. I mean, I'm giving it away. Maybe if I could sell, a gallon for $20, I'd sell it. And so I go into the barn, and we had, you know, security on it. So I go in and I fire up the still, and I put the mash in, and I'm cooking it, and here comes the, you know, the bourbon's coming out. And my brother calls me, Mike, and he says, "Hey, the alarm's going off at the barn. What's the deal?" And I'm like, "Well, I've been here for, you know, 3 hours getting the still up and running." He goes, "Well, I didn't know you were there, so the cops are coming."
And that is moonshine.
No, we're moonshining to the max. I mean, there's jugs laying around, barrels laying around, everything. If you can just picture a moonshining operation, this is what's happening. And so I look down, and there's a 700-foot driveway going up to, you know, Round Bottom Road. And I look out, and here's coming down the road, and I'm like, "Oh, this is not going to end well."
This is not going to end well.
Yeah, this is not going to end, because this thing's boiling. I mean, it's hissing, and I got water running to it, and, you know, out of the condenser comes the warm water that I'm just draining on the driveway that's out front. It's a gravel driveway. Yeah. So I'm like, there's no denying what's going on here. So I run out. Yeah, I shut the garage door. I mean, it's a barn. I shut the barn door, and the police pull up, and I'm like walking as far down the driveway as I can get. I'm like, "Hey, I'm Terry Shumrick, and it's okay, you know." And they're like, "Oh, okay." And they're, you know, they get out of their car, and they're looking around. They're like, "What the hell's going on here?" And I said, "Well, you know, I don't know what's going on here. Why would there be something going on here, you know?" And some reaction.
Always act innocent.
Yeah. And the guy goes, "Well, what's in the barn?" And I'm like, "You know, lawnmower equipment, rotor tiller. Do you want the inventory of what's in there?" And the guy's looking at me in the water, and I could hear that this still hissing. And he's like, okay, we got this. All right. No problem. You got a lawnmower in there." I'm like, yeah, big lawnmower. I'm
running.
It.
Hear that noise?
Yeah, it's running.
Hear the noise?
Yeah.
That's the lawnmower.
Yeah. And so they look at each other, and I'm like trying to walk them back to their car. And they get in their car, and they spin around and take off and leave, you know. And I'm like, I better have a shot of some 120 proof white dog coming out of that thing, because that was really close.
That was close, Instead of talking to me, you could have been in jail.
Well, subsequently, I learned that, you know, the police force does not act upon a federal offense. So when you're making moonshine, that's a federal thing. It's not a local thing. So then I decided I better get a license. So then I got a license, and now I run a 500-gallon still and a 1,000-gallon still. So it's a lot different, and it's a beautiful thing now. So and my copper stills are, you know, they only had, you know, steam up, a condenser, and out. Now the 500-gallon still, you know, we've got a deflagometer up on top. We can, you know, cut the water going to it. We can chill it. We can open it wide open. I mean, there's so many different, you know, parameters that we can roll by depending on what we're trying to make. So it's a lot more fun.
Yeah, I can imagine. So do you have a label for your spirits there? What is it?
No. Well, actually, we do. It's called Robert James. And that's the company that I work for. But I also do some things over on the side for myself that we do not have a label for yet.
I see.
That's to come.
Oh, okay. Very good.
Yeah.
Is there a tasting room for your spirits? Or,
No, there is no tasting rooms for the spirits. We did have a tasting room when it was called Shumrick and Lees. I had two partners, and it was Shumrick and Lees. It was Bill Easley and Tad Hinckley. And we had a tasting room, and we had a bar, and we had bands, and you know, the whole nine yards. But when the bigger company came in, You know, they just said, here's the money. And we're like, ah, shoot, you know, maybe we ought to take this. In retrospect, we should not have taken it. And we should have kept doing what we were doing. But, you know, I mean, what, you know, somebody dangles that carrot out there and you're hungry. What do?
You grab it. Yeah. And that's,
yeah.
Yeah. Not, that's no, probably. Very understandable. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what we did. But I still make, you know, some really, really good bourbons, some rye, rum, agave, vodka. Yeah. So, I mean, I still get to do all the things that I've been doing. And every day I tweak it a little this way, a little that way. It's like being an artist. I mean, there is definitely an art to making, you know, winemaking and bourbon. So it's good.
No, any spirits. That's an art to get it just right. So, and, you know, wine, you put that in your mouth and it's just like, oh, you know, a nectar of heaven here. And
sure.
I understand that completely.
Yeah.
So
if you guys ever come to Cincinnati, you know, definitely call me.
Oh,
I will definitely show you some red carpet treatment that will just blow you away. Yeah, it's very, very interesting when you're up close and you can touch it and see it and smell it and feel the heat, you know, all the whole thing.
That sounds great. So the movie, let's address that one more time here. So the movie, next step is going to be see if someone's going to get it. You mentioned January. Is this a month we can look forward to being able to view it somehow, or what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, so the name of the movie is Wine Thief. So if you go on YouTube and you type in Wine Thief trailer, you'll be able to see it. So we're going to sell it in early November. So the streaming services that are going to put it up, we're anticipating January, but if they really like it, it may be in December. There is no content. Yeah, there's no content right now with the strike that's going on with all the actors and the, you know.
True.
So so we feel that we're in a really good position to, you know, maybe make a little extra money on the movie than if we were, you know, back in last December, when there's a lot of content out there. So it's going to be interesting to see. It's exciting, but yeah, we're looking, I'm just saying January because it could be before that, but I don't want to say that because, you know, I don't know. I'm on the acting side and that thing.
Promo.
So yeah, exactly. I have to go out there and put a hat on and look, you know, like a character. So it's going to be
there
fun.
You go. Yeah, good. Mike, is there any questions, any comments you want to make to Jerry?
Yeah, actually, I was checking online just to make sure no one jumped in there, but you mentioned you're a master distiller, and I don't think we've covered that process yet because we've had sommeliers on, we've had master winemaker, and that is, are there different levels as a master distiller? What's the process to get that?
Well, okay, that's a very, very good question. So a lot of people ask that, and a lot of times I just tell people I'm just a distiller, so I don't have to answer this question. But But what I do differently than most people that make bourbons, you know, most people, you know, go with 70% corn, 25% rye for a high rye, and, you know, 5% something else. I like to use extra malts in mine, like a chocolate malt, a caramel malt. You know, I like to go a little bit over to the left-hand side of the bourbon spectrum so that when you taste my stuff, I can say, look, I've got a completely different story than everybody else. So when you ask, are you a master distiller? I'm like, absolutely, because if you're making your stuff over on the right-hand side, you are just following a recipe that everybody in America is doing, and I'm trying to create these really neat bourbons and ryes that are over on the left-hand side with some really cool malts, some you know, some different barrel techniques that we use to put these different notes in it, but still make it taste, you know, on the bourbon side. I don't want to put it in a sherry you know, barrel, and then you get these funky flavors out of it. It's all brand new barrels. So to be a master distiller, I mean, I feel like you need to be, you know, something that's other than everyday bourbon making.
Uh-huh. Yeah, very good. Okay, cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Just wondering. Let me see. Winemaker. No. I think that's it. Yeah, I was just curious about that. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean the bourbon thing is so interesting because you really have to have a craft, in my opinion. Mm. And when I visit all these, you know, distilleries, and I love all the people there, but I'm always thinking, just think if you did it this way or if you did it that way. You're just, you know, like in the wine business, like we talked earlier, you took a Riesling from sweet to dry. Why do you have to take a bourbon from, you know, 70-25-5 when you could be adding all these extra complex malts in there and make something really, really, really neat? And, you know, so, yeah, that's what a master distiller does.
Bourbon. Cool. Okay. Now, I understood that bourbon comes from Kentucky, but you're not in Kentucky. You're
yeah, no.
In...
That... All right, so this is another great question, and I hope everybody listens to this. Bourbon can be made in all 50 states. It's not just made in Kentucky. Bourbon County, Kentucky, was the largest county in Kentucky back in like the 1900s. And that's when they started making bourbon back there. And that's why they called it bourbon, because it was made in Bourbon County, Kentucky. And that's how that name came about. And now in America, you can make it in all 50 states. And it's the only place that you can make bourbon. You can't make it down in Mexico, in France. You can't make it in Japan. I mean, that word is an American word, and you can only make it here. Now, the parameters to make bourbon, you have to have at least 51% corn in a bourbon mix. So, and you have to age it in a brand new oak barrel. And to call it straight bourbon whiskey, it has to stay in that barrel for 4 years.
Oh,
so
wow.
That's kind of the collective. Those are the parameters that bourbon have.
Okay. You know, because I've seen bourbon advertised from other places, and I'm thinking, isn't bourbon only from Kentucky? But I
no.
guess that's something no. that I misinterpreted or wasn't explained to me.
Here's something else that's interesting. So Kentucky, from where I'm sitting, is probably 4 miles. People will buy a Kentucky bourbon that's 4 miles away from me, you know, 10 times over an Ohio bourbon that's 4 miles away from Kentucky. Yeah, they get $50. I only get $35. But the stigma of good bourbons is slowly turning to a thing that can be made in all 50 states. I mean, you go to Colorado, they're known for a couple different bourbons out there that are really good. You go to California, there's a couple bourbons that are really good. So the stigma of it's only coming from Kentucky is slowly, you know, dissolving, if I could say that.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, and you've got the big bourbon makers that are in Kentucky who are fighting that dissolve quite strongly.
Yep.
So,
big.
You know, they're fighting against that all the time, too. You know, I mean, you know, Buffalo Trace doesn't want California to be making a bourbon as well as them. So, you know, they're going to battle that. So.
Well, and you know, when I consult with people, the one thing I say is, you know, they're doing traditional bourbon. You know, I went to Knob Creek and I was taking a tour, and at the end of the tour, the guys, you know, I taste some bourbon. I'm like, you know, I don't know if I like this. And they go, well, we've been making this bourbon, you know, for 100 years the exact same way. And I looked at them, I said, I think, yeah, you need to change your recipe, man, because, I mean, yeah. Yeah,
after
and they kicked my
years.
Ass out. They said, yeah, they said, you're out of here. Yeah. Yeah. You don't know how long a walk it is to the handicapped parking spot where I was parking to get the hell out of there, man. I just wanted to burn rubber and leave. Yeah.
Yeah, see, you should have been a character instead of yourself there.
I know. I should have not said the truth, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Now I don't say anything like that. If I go to a winery or distillery, I'm like, oh, I like this. Yeah, good job, you know, because that's just what you have to, you know, they know, and I know, everybody knows, yeah.
Everybody knows, yeah, that's what you have
everybody
to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Terry, I'm going to let you go for the night. Thank you so very much for coming on. It was really quite enjoyable and a lot of fun. And when Wine Thief comes out, when there's a place where people can see it, give me an email. Drop me an email I can announce it on the show and let people know and all that what's happening with it.
Yeah, that'd be great. I certainly appreciate that.
Yeah, because people will overlook it, or they won't see it unless they're actually looking for it, because that's the way it is with most movies and shows and stuff like that. And unless you're actually looking for it, you just miss it. So, but sure. If you let me know, drop me an email or have your publicist, I can't think of her name at the moment. But have her let me know.
Jen,
there you go.
Yeah.
Have Jen let me know. But let us know when it's going to come out and where it's going to be, and I'll get it announced, and I'll put up on my Facebook page and all that stuff on All About Wine. So, thank
you
so
much. Guys, this has
been
great. I feel like I'm back on the radio again. It's just been exciting. Yeah.
And,
you know,
that's been fun. It's been very enjoyable. So, thanks for taking the time to join us tonight. It was fun. It really was. So
yeah, it was great.
And if you get yourself signed up for any other acting jobs, get in touch. We'll get you on. Let you talk about those.
I will. I appreciate it. Thank you.
And anybody that's up in Cincinnati,
thank you very much.
Check out the bourbon and the wines and all that up there.
Yeah, just Google my name, Terry Shumrick, and they can get a hold of me.
Very good. Well, thank you again,
thank you.
Terry, and have yourself a good evening.
All right. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it so much.
Yeah.
All right. See you. Bye.
Bye now.
Bye. All right. There we are. Okay. Well, that was cool.
That was fun. That was fun. That was a fun time. So, all right. So once we find out anything about the Wine Thief, we will pass it on to everybody, and so they can check it out, whatever venue or however it's going to be on. That's funny that he's talking about TV and stuff like that. Never mentioned anything like online, and so many of the people we've talked to and who have made movies have brought him out online. But he's talking about other venues. So, no, I thought that was curious. So.
All righty. Let's see. What else do we have? I'm going to save this here. So, a
couple of things I want to add. Reiterate on the flood, on the hurricane, if... there's a lot of damage around here and all that. If you're so inclined, American Red Cross, and signify that you want it donated to the hurricane relief, Idalia. Where they got that name, Idalia? I don't know. There's so many other eyes out there. But let them know. And also, we would be derelict of our responsibilities without mentioning Mike's radio. Oh.
Thank you.
Flightline Radio, the whole thing, flightlineradio.com. And he's 24/7 streaming, and he is live on Saturday mornings from 7 to 9 a.m. And a repeat of All About Wine is always on Saturdays at noon, so you can tune in on that. And, there's music all the time. You can always turn on the computer and turn on flightlineradio.com and just go and do your surfing or whatever you're doing and just listen to that in the background. I mean, that's It's a good way to do it.
Thank you.
Pull it up.
I do that flight. Myself on the way home from work. I just tune. I mean, it's only like 10 minutes, but I listen to it.
But it's enough. Yeah. Well, I'll plug it in and, you know, and pull it up and just listen to it in the background while I'm, you know, surfing through stuff and all that. And so
it's kind of early. But, yeah, it's an early time frame, but
you're too early in the morning on Saturday now. On Friday evening, I used to listen to you, but Saturday morning, you're asking a lot there, Mike, for me to get up.
that's a tough one.
That is tough. Yeah. You know, that is a tough one.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. And last week I announced that I did the replay on Sunday, and then I looked, I was doing something to get the show started. I got that. Thank you very much on, where'd that come from? Facebook, Find Us Wine Thief. And I've seen the name before. Is it Lana or Elena? L-A-N-A.
I don't know.
The one on YouTube that the YouTube trailer. Anybody out there, go on YouTube if you want to see a trailer. I watched it before the show, and Ron told me about it. And go on YouTube, Google Wine Thief trailer, and it's like the top link up there. And definitely check out the trailer. We've had some that are on here, and I'm thinking it's a home movie. No, this is an actual movie.
It's
a
well
professional. I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. So I can't wait to see this come out, definitely, and wish it, you know, the best of luck, and, you know, prosperous, what other words out there, but I hope it does well when they pitch it, and people, you know, the outlets buy into it, and it takes off. So
it's a comedy. Thank you for it. You know, when you start doing wine movies, most of the time they're not. They're documentary type styles. And to get something that's a comedy, it should be interesting. Should be fun.
That's what got me on the trailer. I looked at that and I go, oh, this isn't like a documentary, you know, filmed with a GoPro and a selfie stick. You know, this is actually fun. You know, it was very impressive. So, yeah, thank you very much for the quick chat there off of Facebook. I appreciate it. But go on Google, search for Wine Thief trailer, and you'll watch the trailer. It's about 2 minutes long, I think, maybe 2 minutes and change. But,
2:10, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, very good. Thank you for that. And, well, I'm sure we'll be talking about it more as the time goes on. But
I think
we're mentioning that.
I'm looking forward to watching it myself. Actual movie. So
Just caught that. All right, we are going to be signing out for our last broadcast of August. The next show will be September the 7th. That is next Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, live right here on. I don't know how many outlets we're on now, but we're live on Blog Talk Radio, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Flightline Radio without the video. So thank you all very much, and have a great week. Be safe, and we'll talk to you next time. Thank you.
Check out the our guest next week, and I don't have him in front of me right now, but we do have a guest coming up next week. So
Jerry Eisterhold. Was Jerry, right?
I think so.
One of three guys podcast. Terravox Winery.
Terravox Winery. Yeah. There you go. Okay. Yeah. He's the he's the other one. Another one that's we talked about, American native grapes, a couple of weeks ago. Well, he's another one who has an actual winery in Missouri, Western Missouri, and he grows all sorts of American grapes. So that should be another interesting show. So tune in for that next week. I wanted to give him a quick plug before we went on here.
Very cool. Yeah, we'll have a live next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
Talk to
be
you.
Safe. Bye. See you next week.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine, with your host, Ron. For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on this show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.
All About Wine.
All right. Oh, all right. Very good. Go back to the green room.
Go to the green room. Go to the green room.